Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty at Vanderbilt University. I'm Chris Benda, librarian for religious studies and theology at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with William Franke, professor of comparative literature and religious studies, about his recent book, A Theology of Literature, The Bible as Revelation in the Tradition of the Humanities. William, thanks for agreeing to a conversation with me.
Well, thanks for doing it, Chris.
The main title of your book, A Theology of Literature, is rather expansive in scope. It's actually the title of a manifesto, I think. while the subtitle, The Bible as Revelation in the Tradition of the Humanities, narrows the focus to a particular text, the Bible. The title as a whole seems to adumbrate your conception of the relationship between literature and the Bible. What is that relationship?
Well, very much an internal connection between literature and the Bible. I would not really want to conceive of one or the other separately. Literature, I want to understand as being inherently revelatory. And the Bible, I want to understand as being inherently literary as well. Its very way of communicating, I think, cannot really be understood unless we take the literary aspects of it very seriously. I think that both literature, then, and the Bible are concerned with sounding the infinite and unfathomable purpose and meaning of all life, the miraculous and the revelatory and or the life-redeeming and saving become not just fantasy but something real if we think of creative imagination and divine revelation together and as inseparable. And I would like to pick up on your suggestion there that the book is a manifesto for literature as well as for theology. I do see it that way, and it sees literature really as a revelation of the highest sort of truth of which the human intellect and the human heart are capable, and at the same time as a manifesto for theology as the source and core of traditions of human knowledge. I take the Bible as really the outstanding example of both types of discourse, literature and theology, in some of their most marvelous and miraculous revelatory capacities.
You've actually used the word revelation, revelatory, a lot in your comments just now. So what do you mean when you speak of the Bible as revelation?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to give you just, you know, my own hermetic definition. I don't mean something that's completely divorced from what others mean by revelation, mm-hmm. whether these are fundamentalists or the Catholic Church or the Protestant Church or the Orthodox Church or even secularists. I want to communicate really with all the various possible ways of understanding what revelation means. But it, you know, I think one core idea to start from is the idea that God is speaking, or at least represented as speaking, right, for secularists. That's fundamental. But this speaking can mean, I think, a kind of speaking in the way that literature speaks, or even that language speaks. You know, Heidegger says, die Sprache spricht, language itself speaks. And I too would say that literature really says a lot by what it is, and it reveals more than it can say as such. That's why we read it. And it enables us really to see more deeply into the truth of things and of ourselves. By literary forms reveal an unconscious mind and an incomprehensible reality more than what we can say. Now, you know, religious revelation, by the word of God, as it's understood in classical theology, and then revelation by phenomenological revealment of the disclosedness of beings seem to be widely different and, you know, totally incompatible senses of revelation. But I really do want to bring them together and suggest that the deepest insight comes from sounding their common source and background of intelligibility, and that neither can really be understood in isolation from the other. Even to understand the Word of God, there's some sort of a framework, some sort of a presupposition in human receptivity, in human intelligence. That's part of the revelation of the Word of God. And on the other side, the way in which what I just called phenomenological revelation takes place has to also be by some kind of a transcendence of the normal capacities of the mind. And what we find then in these humanities texts, exemplarily in the Bible, is some sort of an uncanny insight into the nature of reality as a whole and in its deepest core. Revelation conveys an unlimited intelligence of life and of everything that concerns us as humans. So I recognize knowledge as revealed to the extent that it rises beyond ordinary limits to a degree of knowing that somehow fathoms the whole or the total or the infinite. And this means for many that revelation comes from God. But even before presupposing that we know anything about God, we can simply let revelation emerge from this extraordinary capacity of the mind to transcend itself in a feeling connectedness with all things toward what it cannot comprehend. And I think we experience in certain encounters with others an infinite depth of love, it can be, of life in any case, that boggles the mind and exceeds our comprehension, and that can transform our lives. Theological revelation is a compelling interpretation, I think, of this experience, one that's handed down over generations in the human community. It's this mind-transcending register of experience that, in any case, is accessed through what I'm calling revelation. Now, I'm tempted to bring in a dimension of self-reflection, which is crucial to my thinking about revelation as well. There is an element, I think, of the self-reflexive in, you know, either direction, whether we want, you know, for understanding revelation, whether we want to take it more in the scriptural sense or in the phenomenological sense. Knowledge that it has to be self-reflexive in order to discern its own limits, and then in order to somehow or other fathom or have some inkling of what is beyond knowledge. There's this interface with the unknown that I think is very much a part of revelation as well. Even the word suggests that to us by saying reveal is to reveal, right? If we want to take that word apart, there's always a recognition in revelation of what remains unrevealed. A revelation of God par excellence. God is beyond any kind of human comprehension. So revealing God is inevitably revealing the unrevealable. Now, I also want very much to emphasize the continuity between theological revelation and then this more general revelation in a phenomenological sense of things simply coming to be known or openly disclosed. This, to me, is important in order to keep theology connected with the rest of human knowledge. Human knowledge itself all along harbors something that transcends it and all of its finite means. And I say all along, really, even in the back of my mind, the axial age, which is, you know, out of which the Hebrew prophets come, together with the pre-Socratic philosophers in Greece and Lao Tzu and Confucius in China. And these are all instances where there's some sort of a self-transcendence, a self-reflected, there's a critical moment in all of them, actually. It's critical self-reflective moment that opens beyond the capacities of the finite towards an apprehension of the infinite. This, I think, is very relevant to understanding revelation, even though it's not that I want to replace the idea of, you know, then I was in the Spirit. The word of the Lord came to me. The objective terms that are used for describing the experience of revelation, for example, by the Hebrew prophets, I consider to be authentic testimony of the experience that I'm alluding to here and describing in certain of its aspects, but not in order to replace other, even more positivistic ways of speaking about this experience of revelation.
I wanted to pick up actually on what you said about reveiling, revelation as reveiling. So are you saying in some sense that which is being revealed is at the same time hiding itself?
Yes, yes, absolutely. The veil, to reveal, apokalypsis, of course, in the Greek is to take the veil away. So at a first degree, then you would see what is behind the veil. But what's behind the veil is itself really another kind of a veil, to the extent that the revelation takes place in language. Whenever we translate God or the holy or even the uncanny into words, we have put another veil around it, because this experience, the quintessence of religious experience, is something that is ineffable, that is recalcitrant to any formulation in words. So, this revelation as reveiling is simply reflecting on the fact that a linguistic transformation and translation of the experience of the absolute and the holy is inevitably a form of veiling it. And hiding it once again. I think it's an inescapable dialectic. Whatever means we use in order to reveal, those means are going to become, again, the veil. And literature is very much about examining those veils, reflecting on them to see that they are veils, and then in order to fathom something that the veil enables to be glimpsed as not understood, or it can be revealed in brilliantly colorful and detailed terms. The visions of Ezekiel, for example, and I appreciate enormously the vivid and objective imagination that is deployed in those visions. But we have to see what's not being distilled into those images as well. Otherwise we're idolaters. If we identify God and the Holy with a form and a finite description, and I think the prophets are well aware of that. We've forgotten the nature of imagination as a form of revelation because of the objective biases of our rationalistic culture, thinking that, you know, things, real things and ultimate things can be exactly as they're described. And that's, you know, by reading literature and especially the Bible, can be quite an aid to learning, I think, different forms of understanding that were much friendlier to the world, really the human world, of what is not simply objective, of what consists in relationships and of infinite worth, infinite values that we experience in ethical imperatives or in love, things that cannot be exhaustively objectified.
And I think we'll pick up a little bit later on that shift that you talk about from an earlier way of reading to a more sort of scientific way. But before we get there, I wanted to ask you, since your book talks about the Bible and literature, it brings to mind to anybody who knows anything about literary studies and biblical studies over the last few decades, the whole Bible as literature movement. One of the practitioners of the movement, Robert Alter, is somebody that you cite several times in your book. To the extent that this movement has some kind of unified approach in analyzing biblical literature, how does your approach differ? Which aspects of the Bible as literature approach are, in your view, problematic, at least for your project, and which do you find of continuing value?
Well, the tendency to reduce the Bible to mere literature is the approach that I wish to eschew. We think we know that literature is merely a human construction without anything miraculous about it. But I emphasize that the Bible is truly revelatory as literature. And this enables us to understand theological revelation, too, in a non-dogmatic sense, as having a much more general human validity. Appreciating the literary qualities and excellence of the Bible remains as crucial to my project as to the traditional Bible as literature approach. However, I stress that these literary features are not merely aesthetic effects or ornaments. They are revelatory of the real, the ultimately real and true, which exceeds objectification, and its inevitable oppositions cannot be apprehended except through the imagination. So I'm resisting reading the Bible as merely literature. Right? You know, people are more comfortable with taking it that way because then you don't have to deal with any of the imponderable and unmasterable ideas such as inspiration and revelation. And, you know, the Bible as literature typically belongs to secularizing approaches, though that's not Robert Alter's track, but many will read Alter and use him in precisely that way. Now, you know, I'm taking a maximal view of the Bible as literature and saying that it is revelatory because it is literature, not in spite of that. It's really by being appreciated fully as literature, in my sense, that the Bible is exalted to the status of a true and authentic revelation of divinity, rather than being reduced to only the aspect of itself that fits into the frame of what secular culture can recognize and validate. You know, but we might think of literature in terms of l'espace littéraire, right, of the space of literature, is theorized by Maurice Blanchot as open and infinite. That's the dimension that literature accesses. It's not just what is expressly and literally said, but what is silently evoked as surrounding the said. That is of the essence in literature. So meaning is thrown open and not confined and becomes revelation. And of course, you know, revelation of divinity is inevitably, again, revelation of something indeterminate for human thought and language. Mm. It's really uncontrolled, cannot be confined by rational guideposts. Now, you know, the usual idea of the Bible as literature is that one can read the Bible just as good literature without presupposing any kind of religious belief, and this makes it palatable to many who would otherwise not be interested. But my approach is to read the Bible for all that it's worth as literature, which consists in revelation in and through language. But in reading it as literature, I find precisely the Bible's most challenging, authentic, and compelling theology. Understanding literature in its furthest purport requires a kind of belief in the revelatory powers of language and the Word. It entails a hopeful, loving, and faithful sort of understanding of what is said, and that already constitutes the rudiments of a theology. I would stress, however, that this faith in the revelatory power of the Word is vested not in overestimating its power and stability. It is rather when the Word breaks down that it becomes truly revelatory and lets the other, the numinous, the mysterious, shine through. So when I say, you know, faith in the Word, it's not, you know, what, that the Word is, what, invulnerable to deconstruction. No, it's not that at all. It's letting the Word be what it is. And as I say, it's really when it breaks down in its capacity to communicate the intentions of the speaker that this other dimension, which is revelatory, can open up.
Mm-hmm. I almost want to ask this question, next question, a little bit differently, but I'll go with it as I have it. And then, your book's concerned with the Bible as a humanities text, and actually, you've used the term literature a lot in your comments so far. So one thing I'm curious about is there a difference between when you talk about literature and when you talk about humanities texts? Are they the same thing? Mm-hmm. Is literature a subset of the humanities texts? Mm-hmm. So that would be one question that I would have. Another has to do with how we designate what a literary or a humanities text is. I mean, is any text potentially a literary or humanities text, or is it just, or what you're talking about, is it a way of reading the text?
Yes, it is. And, you know, I would resist the categorizations, you know, is literature then a subcategory of humanities text? The way I'm using literature is a way of getting at something about humanities texts, and not only humanities texts, really. There could be a literary dimension in science texts as well. And what is a science text if it's not, in some sense, also a humanities text? A text, you know, that is written by human beings in order to convey some sort of human understanding. Of course, it can be written in a technical language and be subject to a purely objective algorithm, but and insofar then it's not revealing the nature of the humanities texts, and there's nothing literary about it, except that even that, you know, purely technical discourse, in order to be meaningful, in order to have its human relevance, there has to be more to it. And in order for that text to become meaningful for us as human beings, we're going to have to reframe it in some sort of a way that gives it a literary dimension, that it's, well, a and would make it in some sense a humanities text. Mm. So I don't want to rigidly categorize, differentiate here. Literature is an aspect. The literary is an aspect of any text. It's one that I pick up on in order to try to open the unfathomable, infinite kinds of meaning that inhabit human communications at some level. They become central in many of the humanities texts, especially literary texts. They're very peripheral in other texts, but I think that they are marginally present even in a science text, to the extent that it really wants to say something to human beings and not simply be a digital formula. See, what I take to be characteristic of humanities texts is that they are not just about one thing, one subject area. Mm. The humanities text is about everything all at once, taken up from a certain angle of vision. Fundamentally, the humanities text is about how everything relates together. But, you know, they fall into different disciplines, right? The liberal arts. Astronomy was one of the classical seven liberal arts. And it's a way of looking at the cosmos. Mm. From a certain point of view, to study any of the liberal arts and then the other disciplines that we have in the university today that are the outgrowth of this core curriculum, to study any of those disciplines, whether anthropology or political science or whatever it might be, is to study from a certain point of view the whole. We tend to think, and this is the bias of our scientific categorical way of thinking, that anthropology has to be separate from even from sociology, not to mention from theology or whatever. But that's a very limiting point of view that in some way obscures the very ethos and the whole reason for being of humanities, of any of the humanities disciplines. It's not to simply acquire a specific technical expertise in a circumscribed field. It's rather to get some angle of vision on the whole of things. I often quote to my students in humanities courses, I give astronomy as an example of one of the liberal arts and suggest that then a very primitive, a sort of primordial form of astronomy is expressed in the Bible, in the eighth psalm, when I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the sun and it's the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained. What is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that thou considerest him? It's interesting, there's that self-reflexive moment there in this dialogue between a human voice and the Almighty. But there's already, in some sense, the essence of astronomy is expressed in this text. What does this all mean? That question has to animate astronomy if it's going to continue and survive as a human pursuit, as part of our liberal arts curriculum, which does include the sciences, actually, the quadrivium, as well as the language arts, the trivium. They do go together. They're all part of our attempt to understand ourselves in unlimited relations, in relation to the all. I say unlimited because we don't really grasp the all as such. The real meaning of that is relations without limit. Mm. This is how Augustine understands the humanistic disciplines. You said humanistically, and I did actually recoil a little bit from just, you know, adding that nuance to say, you know, humanistic. That gives a certain turn to humanity studies that I would really in some way want to resist, because it tries to make the concept more precise, you know, turning it into a specific quality rather than, you know, simply an adjectival mode. It also tends to make it more abstract. As, you know, there is this certain, you know, the humanistic would be separated out, we could define it. And that's really what conceptual and academic thinking do. But thinking literarily moves in the other direction, toward a greater concreteness, notably through metaphor. And in my treating the Bible as a humanities text, the human is not more sharply defined, but is rather undefined, so that it is not even distinct from the divine. The human becomes an inflection of something that can also be inflected as divine. They're connected and inseparable. The one comes to consciousness in and through the other. Now, you know, I don't mean to be saying that there's then no difference. I'm saying that any difference is defined in words, and therefore not the real and ultimate difference, but an abstraction that presupposes some sort of a common ground as well. In words, humanity and divinity can only be reciprocally defined, whereas in reality, they may be leagues or light years apart as far as the infinite from the finite. But the best we can do is to conceive of them as different degrees of being, the finite and the infinite. And there's no proportion between the finite and the infinite, according to scholastic theology. Duns Scotus and even Spinoza and Deleuze carry this notion through. But, you know, actually, I've now gone into another project. Sorry.
Oh.
I didn't mean to go there.
That's all right.
Yeah. That's part of, you know, the self-reflection book, which is on the way, and we'll have a conversation okay. Right in due course about that as well.
Well, I think you've mentioned some figures in the last minute or so that connect in some ways with the next question I'm going to ask, which has to do with how texts have been read. You state prior to modernity, texts, including the Bible, quote, exercised sovereign authority in determining their own meaning, and in interrogating the reader and potentially challenging the reader's insight and very integrity, unquote. And you mentioned Augustine, Duns Scotus. In secular modernity, by contrast, you say that, quote, texts taken as specimens for analysis are dissected according to the will and criteria of a knowing subject considered to be wholly external to them, unquote. And you talked earlier about the way we tend to objectify things, and I think we see this as well in the divisions that we see in the university between the various disciplines. A theology of literature approaches the Bible through what you call the post-secular turn of postmodern culture, which seems to counter the secular readings of texts by reinvigorating the authoritativeness of those texts. In what ways does this post-secular approach differ from the pre-modern approach, which also seems to be wanting to give the texts their due, their voice? And are there dangers that accompany this recovery of the sovereign authority of texts in our current post-secular, post-modern age?
Oh, okay, right. Well, the modern secular era is the era of the individual knowing subject, right? The self-conscious human subject becomes the ground and foundation of all knowing. This is Descartes, I think, therefore I am, as the inaugural proposition of modern philosophy. Hegel construed the history of philosophy along these lines, beginning from Descartes. And texts become artifacts created by finite human subjects. Prior to this modern era and its constitutive narcissism, the creation of the text was a much more open affair. It was not under the control of a unitary finite subject, the author. This is how I read medieval literature, especially, that human authors could be channels for revelations from beyond their own ken, and readers could explore texts for revelations from a higher authority than just the author's own intention. Augustine's reading of the Bible as meaning infinitely more than its presumable human authors, starting with Moses, were able to comprehend, is a good example of this, you know, in the Confessions. Now, about the dangers of sovereign authority, you rightly point out that exalting the authority of the text in this way is open to abuse. The post-secular approach recovers authority, however, only in a critical and post-critical way that undermines every finite claim to authority, including the claims of secular reason itself, based on the authority of a self-reflective subject. That subject is no longer the foundation for knowing, but itself becomes very dubious and an artificial construction relying on processes of reflection. So the true authority in literature is vested in what I'm calling the infinite, or we could say maybe love of life, and responsibility towards every creature without limits. The text as literature, the authority that it has is decentralized, and it's always open to reinterpretation by what comes next, or what is always coming or to come. This is eschatological in orientation. And this means that there's always a mediation at the receiving end, and a choice of what one is going to be receptive to, and for this, the responsibility of the individual who is doing the interpreting is unlimited. So, this is a responsibility to all. I don't think we can set any limits to that responsibility of the reader. You have to be responsive. In theory, obviously, there are all sorts of practical limits, but the authority that emerges from literature, as I'm proposing it here, can no longer be definitively fixed or limited. Nevertheless, it does have to be responsibly justified. That is, the reader has to take responsibility for whatever interpretation they are drawing out of the text in question. And this entails, I think, a responsiveness to all concerned. So the authority of texts, when read in the perspective of a theology of literature, such as I propose it, never exempts the reader from responsibility for the implications and consequences that they draw from the text. The authoritativeness of the infinite potential for meaning that is inherent in these texts is in a dimension of depth that underlies all meanings and all beings and all creatures. It does not valorize some over others. Those determinations are always made by human beings. And they alone, those human beings, bear the responsibility for their choices and acts. The power and authority of the text resides in its infinite potential before the emergence of any divisive distinctions and oppositions. So, you know, the text is not going to be able to, you know, to support mm-hmm. one party against the other. It's always going to take us back to the infinite potential, really, in which all of those various factions are already embraced together. Mm. And that's really what we have to find if we're going to be able to negotiate our differences and, you know, somehow or other resolve disputes among human beings, who, you know, are absolutely responsible for the authority that is then attributed to the text. What the text is revealing is our infinite responsibility for whatever we claim to be the true and authoritative message conveyed by any text. And, you know, we as human beings are answerable for whether or not the interpretation that we propose protects and fosters all creatures in the creation. Now, you know, that maybe sounds a little bit too utopian. So I think I would like to add that, mm-hmm. you know, certainly the dangers of attributing authority to texts like the Bible or the Quran are patent. You know, we see this all the time. And unreflective claims to authority are manipulated to seduce suicide bombers and terrorists. But we need to find and focus on true authority in order to parry our susceptibility to false and dangerous authorities. And, you know, the true authority, I think, has to be this authority that is not really definable on one side or the other. And so this does not really resolve our disputes, but it puts us in a place where we're connected with one another and with the whole. Once again, and that's the place where we do have to work with and against one another in order to try and find solutions to our human problems.
Would it be simplifying it too much to say, instead of pointing to something and saying some authority, or what we take to be an authority, and saying you are determining what my behavior is, or what my thoughts are, rather than pointing to ourselves and saying my behavior, my thoughts are my responsibility and yours are yours, and we need to work within. We realize that we each have our own things that we're pointing to as authorities, but we need to realize that basically, we need to be talking to one another. I mean, we need to be...
Yes, and we do need to have, I think, authority, a higher authority than either me or you in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
But this mediation that you are now underlining is crucial. Mm. You know, whatever is evoked as authority by either side has to be, you know, claimed as the interpretation that, you know, the responsibility for that authority. So it does lay with the human, you know, participant in this dialogue. But in recognition of a higher authority that actually would be authoritative for both parties and for all parties. So it's an ideal.
That's the utopian aspect of it in
That's
some
right.
ways.
Yeah. Yes. But it's actually totally pragmatically necessary to negotiations among human beings. We have to be able to find, you know, we call it common ground. Right? And that common ground has to not just be on, you know, on my territory or on your territory. Mm-hmm. It really does have to be in a higher place that is authoritative over all of us, and then, you know, we relate to one another through this higher common being that can reveal itself to us if we are patient, and if we can place our own interpretations of authority into question, and that's the only way of letting true authority speak, is by relativizing our own interpretation of that authority. And of course, yeah, but what the other person is not doing that. Nevertheless, the only way to encourage the other person to do that is to do it oneself, to show the way of doing that. And, you know, otherwise you're in war, and maybe you are at war, but if we can suspend the war for the time of, you know, trying to enter into this kind of hermeneutical dialogue that would let authority emerge between us, rather than being claimed by one and the other, but letting us be claimed by it, then there's some chance of being able to end the war, to have a different basis of dealing with each other besides the war. But we do need something beyond just you and me and, you know, our own finite perspectives. But that beyond is not going to be defined either by you or me. And so this is what I'm, recommending. I mean, what I'm recommending. I think it's just a transmission of the wisdom of the ages that we would find in all of the traditions, from the Axial Age forward and even backward as well. But, you put your finger here on an issue of authority, which is absolutely crucial. And the Bible is an authoritative book, and there's another kind of authority that used to belong to the human sciences, one could say, the Geisteswissenschaften, which has been undermined in our contemporary world very much by the hegemony of hard science and techne. But that's why we're missing. We're missing the kind of authority that we need to save us from the tragedies that are really tearing us apart in so many ways. I think that kind of authority is present in these traditions, the humanities traditions, and in the religious traditions that can oftentimes be set up against one another. But if they could understand themselves as part of the humanities traditions, the basis of conflict would erode to a very large extent, I think.
Well, let's actually return to looking specifically at what you are doing in the book, because I think the book doesn't go into the detail that we've been going into about some of these things, but it's the ground upon which I think these issues are growing, out of which they're growing. So a theology of literature, the book that you've written largely consists of explorations of the revelatory aspects of varying literary genres in the Bible. You look at mythology, epic, history, prophecy, apocalyptic, literature, poetry, and gospel. And one concern that recurs through each of these discussions of literary genre is the relationship between the text and the reader, a relationship which you discuss in terms of re-actualization. You quote John 1:14, "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us," and claim that this statement announces a general interpretive principle. The meaning of tradition is experienced only in its application to life in the present. So could you talk a little bit about that, what you mean by that?
Well, meaning and life and literature is much more than just an intellectual sense or a dictionary definition. How words mean is rooted in our way of existing in the world. Words have to take on our own flesh and dwell in and with us in order to realize their full potential to signify. This fact is conveyed poetically by the doctrine of the Incarnation that is clairvoyantly and beautifully expressed in the Gospel of John in that astonishing world-transforming line that you quote.
So, when readers encounter the text, they encounter the word, as you've suggested. The creative word spoken by God in Genesis, the questioning word spoken by humans in the wisdom literature, the embodied word in the Gospel of John that we were just talking about. How is the word revealed in the varying genres of the Bible, and how does that make the Bible, what you've said a number of times throughout our interview, an exemplary humanities text?
Well, the various literary genres represent different ways of shaping language into an embodiment of meaning, and they offer forms of realizing the incarnation of the divine word in language. Myth, for example, and that's the first, right, that I treat in Genesis, concerns revealing fundamental conditions of existence. That's my way of defining it. Adam and Eve represent the human condition concretely as single individuals. We contemplate what it is like to exist as dependent on a superior power and on nature, as gendered. All of that, I think, is contemplated in the Genesis myth, and then Exodus, it gives us a kind of an epic history that reveals the origins and destiny of a people, the story of how they came to be who they are and will be. I call this the Exodus epic, the story of Moses and all the rest. And it then becomes the basis for the prophetic oracles that speak in the voice of God directly and reveal the divine will by a direct address to Isaiah. Isaiah gives us God's voice. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The prophetic voice of God in the oracles is not the only way in which the Bible speaks the Word of God. Also, you have the writings, inspired writings, in which human voices, human sentiments address God, right? The vector is reversed in Ecclesiastes or the Song of Songs or Job. Even though it's not God who is speaking per se, God is revealed by those voices as well. The relationships that they testify to are further revelations of God, the relationship to God, because all of those books discuss human matters in relation to the Almighty, and to that extent, then human words and these literary forms of expression do themselves become ways of revelation. And the Gospels really bring all of these modes together.
Yeah, I wanted to ask how do they?
Mm-hmm. Well, they add an element of proclamation or of personal witness to the truth. You've got myths already in the virgin birth, the resurrection of the body would be treated by Bultmann, for example, as part of the mythology of the New Testament, the Gospels in particular. These are myths that circulate in the ancient world, but they're given a new kind of focus to reveal a truth of existence in the Gospels. Certainly history, a life history, is part of the gospel narration, and there's a lot of prophecy as well, a prophecy of the whole new world, right? The kingdom of God is at hand. And it's even apocalyptic, is a further genre that is also treated in the book as a kind of extension of prophecy. And the artistic forms of the writings are certainly present, both in oral modes as Jesus's parables, and even the lyrical prayer that Jesus gives us. And all of these elements are brought together in the gospel and become then more directly revelation of truth. You know, this is the claim, the gospel truth. They're all really given this focus as a personal truth.
But as well, each one of the individual genres has its own certain revelatory capacity. So yes, the myth has revelatory capacity.
Yes.
Historical, right? The writings, each of them has its own revelatory capacity. Is that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they're played out in the various books of the Bible. There is, some kind of a synthetic energy there, mm-hmm. in the Gospels, which brings them all together. But certainly, the various kinds of revelation of truth are crucial as well.
And you were saying much earlier in our conversation in distinguishing your work, your effort, your project from the Bible as literature, that you take seriously the revelatory capacity of the forms. I mean, that the forms,
yes,
themselves have some sort of,
that's right,
revelatory capacity. Can you talk a little bit about, if you pick a particular form, what makes it specially revelatory as opposed to a separate form, or are they revelatory in similar ways?
Right. Well, no. certainly very, very, very different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Though they probably will communicate with each other as well. As I say, myth, I think, gives us archetypes that reveal existence to us, whereas history is about our identity as a people with a destiny. Those are different aspects, and prophecy does bring in this dimension of a personal relationship then to a divinity, and that casts everything really in a very different idiom. But then the writings bring us back into touch with the human modes of expression, which are always there. I mean, every one of these genres has been a human mode, mm-hmm. of expression, but it's given voice and brought into focus when the speaker talks about human feelings, the passion of love in the Song of Songs, or existential despair in Ecclesiastes, the preacher.
Mm.
There's a correspondence between the various modalities that literature discovers in order to explore human experience, and maybe not just human experience, or not as if human experience were closed. It's open to otherness.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of being human is encountering the other. And all of that is explored in these various genres, which then correspond to different types of revelation.
Hmm. Your book is explicitly interested in the potential of humanities texts, quote, to become life-transforming and world-revealing, unquote. Acknowledging that such texts find a large readership outside the walls of the academy, and thus are not solely the objects of disciplinary scrutiny in institutions of higher education, I wonder if the desire that you articulate, a concern with the life-transforming and world-revealing potential of humanities texts, easily finds a home among the present concerns of the humanities disciplines, or more generally, in the university as it's currently constituted.
Well, I would like to think
is that a loaded question?
Yeah. I mean, I do work hard every day to try and bring that about, but I won't affirm it as a fact. It does happen, but of course, very often it does not. The humanities are in crisis in our technology-driven world. I'm trying to offer some alternative perspectives and visions. We cannot fight these fundamental determinants of historical evolution and destiny. We have to work with them. But we can resist certain of their tendencies, notably toward increasing specialization, by which we lose the vision of the whole. And we can also resist the tendency toward pragmatic technical applications that eclipse meaning in favor of power for changing things, and just things, and not ourselves as a whole, and in relation to others as also potentially wholes. It's relation to those others that can place us in relation to the whole that exceeds us, or to God as the ultimate other. These orientations have all along been the vocation of the humanities, as I understand them. And they do need a defense today, since the dominant powers and pressures are all steering the university, along with our society at large, in the opposite direction, toward an eclipse of the human. The technical turn and development of humanity is part of our destiny and not to be refused. But there's another side, one that it is our duty as humanists not to forget, and that requires poetry and inspiration in both a poetic and a religious sense. And I think the two inextricably, the poetic and the religious. And the university has a vocation to remember our cultural past and a mission of calling to consciousness this deeper dimension of being, of our being, that is missed in digitalization. The humanities today are, I think, the locus of the sacred. And that's why the Bible is so exemplary and revelatory of their nature and potential.
William, thank you again for this conversation.
Thank you, Chris.
Again, I've been talking with William Franke, professor of comparative literature and religious studies, about his recent book, A Theology of Literature, The Bible as Revelation in the Tradition of the Humanities, published by Cascade Books. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.